This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Right now, nearly 450 prisoners who were convicted of crimes in Vermont are serving their sentences in Kentucky. Almost 40 more are in Arizona. They're living in prisons run by the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA. That's a for-profit company that Vermont contracts with. The state's contract is up for renegotiation in just about a year. And some Vermonters are hoping that we could put a plan in place soon, if not by the time we have to renegotiate, that would bring all of Vermont's prisoners back into the state. They say doing that might require the construction of new facilities that could act as halfway houses or finding other ways to reduce the state's prison population. Today, we're going to better understand the situation with out-of-state prisoners and hear some of the arguments for and against it. I'm joined by Andy Polito, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Commissioner Polito, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And by Susie Wizawadi, Executive Director of Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform and a state representative in the Vermont legislature. Susie Wizawadi, nice to have you on the program
Thank
as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Commissioner Polito, help us set this conversation up by explaining why we have prisoners who are housed and serving time out of state in the first place.
So this issue goes back to the mid-90s when prison growth was unprecedented both in Vermont and also in the United States. In Vermont, we were seeing on the order of magnitude 137 more inmates each year over the preceding year, and our ability to house offenders at that rate didn't exist in Vermont because we have small correctional facilities spread throughout. We did some building. We added on building in Newport and a building in Waterbury, a building in Springfield, and that still wasn't enough to keep up with demand. We started out in New Jersey, then we went to Virginia, and ultimately to CCA, predominantly in Kentucky. Today we have about 485 people out of state, which is down from where we were. We were around 600 a couple of years ago, a few years ago, 2010-ish, and we were projected to be over 1,000 out of state, so we've slowed the growth down. But the problem starts when we are putting more people in jail during a period of time than we have the ability to house in Vermont. And we are a state that does not overcrowd our facilities. And so that decision plus the growth results in an out-of-state program.
And Susie Wizawadi, you think it's time, past time, to bring those prisoners back to Vermont?
Yes.
Why?
You know, sending people out of state makes it very hard for them to maintain family connections and connections with the community. And we know that maintaining those connections is the number one best predictor of successful reintegration when people come back. And most of the people out of state, 95% of prisoners, in the country are going to come back to their communities. So everything we can do to help sustain those relationships, we should be doing. And it's virtually impossible, certainly very, very difficult for families to keep in contact and visit and even have phone calls, regular phone calls with folks who are that far away.
Why are the phone calls a problem?
They're expensive.
And the prisoners have to pay for that?
Right.
So is your main argument here for making sure that people who are incarcerated in Vermont serve their time in Vermont, that family connection and that possibility of lowering rates of recidivism because of the community connections? That's the main argument here for bringing them back to Vermont, in your opinion?
That is the main argument. Of course, the second argument is that we shouldn't be using a CCA facility, a for-profit facility anyway. You mentioned new facilities. I do want to make clear that our position is not to build a new facility in Vermont. A new prison.
But new facilities of some sort may be necessary, right?
Certainly new programs and addressing the issue of housing is a priority if we're going to be successful at this effort.
Commissioner Polito, philosophically, and we're going to get into some of the details here, but philosophically, where do you stand on this issue?
Personally, and I also think it reflects the opinion of this administration, I don't disagree with any of the things that Susie said. I think that those are fair and valid points. I think there's an operational reality placed on state government and the Department of Corrections specifically where the public has an expectation, the legislature quantifies that expectation and then places it on the DOC. And so we have a responsibility to keep the community safe, handle people that have been sent to us by the court system, and do it in a way that keeps them safe while they are in the Department of Corrections. And so I think that there's a philosophical piece to this, but there's also the operational reality that we have to implement. I think that the DOC has done a pretty remarkable job in trying to meter all this out. People are safe. We run one of the safest departments of corrections in the country. We have very low instances of violence. We don't overcrowd. All of those things, which are backed by the legislature, all of those things have been maintained while dealing with what was such rapid growth during the mid to late 90s and then the early 2000s.
We're talking today about Vermont's prison population and specifically looking at out-of-state prisoners and whether or not and how they might be brought back to Vermont. Some of that may involve reducing the overall prison population. So that's coming to the conversation as well as we look at this issue of out-of-state prisoners and what we think is right for Vermont. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you if you have opinions on this or if you have a question for Susie Wisawati or for Commissioner Polito about the correction system. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We know some of you have had experiences with family members who may have had time out of state. We'd like to hear what you thought of that and what you think of the situation. If, as Susie Wisawati said, it was difficult for your family to maintain a connection, you can let us know about that. Again, our number 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk a little bit about costs here, because this is obviously a big issue whenever we talk about state budgets, whenever we talk about what it's going to cost for Vermonters to support state programs. It's about half as expensive to have inmates out of state as it is to have them in state. Commissioner Polito, why? What's the discrepancy? Why is that?
So when we send somebody out of state, they generally are brought to the DOC in their first year or two for processing, if you will. So if somebody's given a 10-year minimum and a 20-year maximum and potentially has a sex offense, we have to process, they have to finish their court adjudication process, all those things need to fall into place. Then we make a decision as to where they'll be housed. There's a period between that, after that year 1 or 6 months, whatever the case may be, and when they're ultimately available for programming. So in order to get out on your minimum, if you hear people are out on furlough on their minimum, generally they're compliant with programming.
And by programming, you mean just all of
this? Sex offender programming, mm-hmm, or violence, depending on the particular program that they have to take to get out on their minimum. There's a period between that year 1 and year 7 or 8, if you're using a 10-year minimum, where it's basically just doing time off your sentence. So you're not engaged in anything. Your education's already taken care of, and you're generally healthy. Then you wind up out of state for that period in the middle. When they're out of state, it's basically a place to be, to do your time. So there's no programming. There's not excessive medical or mental health issues. There's no booking units. All those things are born in state. So all that clearance happens in state. Out of state, you're basically in a big holding area, a big open unit, with supervision less than it would be in the state. So we wind up with a much higher cost in state. And so that's why out-of-state tends to be cheaper.
And Susie Wisawati, I want to get you in here, but I just want to clarify just so people, because I think it's also people have questions about who is out-of-state, and you were bringing a couple of those to the front there, Commissioner Polito, but these are people who are not going through risk reduction treatment programming at the time.
Currently, right.
So the people who are going through that kind of programming are in-state. People with major health issues, whether they're physical ailments or mental health issues, are in-state.
Correct.
They are not sent out-of-state. So healthy prisoners,
correct,
who are not doing programming are generally sent out of state, and prisoners who are getting their high school diploma remain in state.
Correct. So all those costs are accumulated in state and out of state. We purchase big living units for a lot of people, and supervision's lower because the units are larger.
And that cost for out of state is about a little under $26,000 per year per bed, and in state it's a little over $58,000 per bed per year. Susie Wisawati, you want to jump in there? That was clarified.
Yeah, I think it's also important for listeners to understand that one of the reasons that the costs are lower in CCA prisons is that the staff is paid minimum wage. They have, as a result, a much higher turnover rate. Even though the supervision is it's true that the supervision is less, and that is not entirely a good thing because the CCA prisons have a much, much higher rate statistically of violence, of inmate-on-inmate violence and staff-on-inmate violence and inmate-on-staff violence. I get a number of letters from folks who are incarcerated in Kentucky, for example, telling me about experiences that they have observed, or fights that they've observed where somebody was just watching and not doing anything because they're not trained particularly.
You mean a staff member?
Staff member, right. They're not trained to intervene. And I also think it's worth pointing out that even though statistically the folks who are sent there are healthier and have fewer mental health and physical health problems, that being in prison is extremely stressful, and people's health tends to disintegrate much faster when they're in prison. So they do end up sometimes having health issues. Now, they're not classified as being severely having severe mental health issues, but some of them do have mental health issues. It's clear. I certainly agree with what Andy said about that is the general characterization of the population, but there are people who are there who would no question be better served in Vermont, both with programming and with better attention to their health care.
Commissioner Polito, do we have any alternatives to CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America? This is, as Susie Wizawati pointed out, it's a for-profit corporation. There have been a lot of complaints, a lot of issues, and not excluding Vermont issues. Even in February, there was an issue of a lockdown with more than 200 Vermont prisoners who had been a series of assaults and some general unrest, and they were put on lockdown. So do we have an alternative?
Well, so we put this contract out to bid every 4 years. We follow Bulletin 3.5, which says contract is good for 2 years, and then you do 2 one-year amendments, and cancelable. Generally speaking, they're cancelable at 30 days. It might be a little longer because of the magnitude of what this contract is.
You mean if we wanted to just say right now we're done?
We're done.
We have a 30-day.
Yeah, it might be different in this contract. It may be a little longer, but in general, those are the construct of Bulletin 3.5. And every time we bid this out, there's not a lot of players in the market, and we are a small consumer of the market. So if we go out and say we need 500 beds somewhere, the bids that come back are not exactly the greatest. The out-of-state market, CCA, I think, owns around 100,000 beds in this business. And so our 500 beds don't get us a lot. We've gone to other places, publicly run places, Virginia, state of Virginia, county government in Massachusetts. I think it was the county government in down south. Haven't really turned out all that well. Same levels of violence are much higher than what CCA puts together. And so Susie and I have had this conversation a lot. The ownership is essentially on the DOC in that when we have an instance of violence, there are certain things we want to see happen, such as a lockdown, such as additional staff, regardless of who the provider is. And so if we're not following through on that, then that's a state issue. But in those instances when we've had issues of violence, and again, our issues of violence in Vermont and even in CCA Vermont,
Because we contract with CCA to provide some services in our in-state prisons.
No, I mean CCA Vermont. I mean our units in Kentucky that are dedicated to Vermonters.
Okay.
No, the state ones are all run by the state. We are still very low compared to what goes on. But when we see things, we ask that they follow through. And if they're not, then that's a whole different issue.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to chime in on this conversation, either share their thoughts or have questions. Let's go first to Hugh calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Hugh. Go ahead.
Good morning or good afternoon. My question is, are we sending Vermonters out of state and housing inmates from other states?
Hugh, good question, and we'll clarify a couple of points there. So first of all, are we sending Vermonters out of state while we have people who have been convicted of crimes in Vermont who are from out of state? Are they here? What can you break that down a little bit for us, Commissioner?
If I understand the question right, do we have non-Vermonters serving time in jail
in Vermont?
In Vermont, and the answer is yes. If they've come to Vermont and they've committed a crime, they are washed within this population somewhere. So depending on their sentence structure, somebody comes into Vermont, commits a drug crime, for instance, which we have a fair amount of coming into Vermont. They're not a non-Vermont residents. They come in and they get picked up and charged and adjudicated and convicted. They ultimately do wind up somewhere in our system. Now, they could go out of state, but generally, like on a drug crime, for instance, maybe a misdemeanor, which means they're doing a short period, so they're in Vermont. Meanwhile, you may have a Vermonter who committed a high violent crime may be spending a significant time out of state. So the answer to that is yes.
And then also we do have federal beds that we basically rent out.
Basically, these are they could be Vermonters, though. I want to be clear. These are people that are in the federal adjudication process, usually in where the federal courts are, Chittenden or Rutland, may be an out-of-state or picked up at the border. We don't really have any control of that. We rent out up to 40 beds. They generally use, I think the last time I looked, around 30 is about their average. They've been as low as 8. They started to go over the 40. We asked them to please not go above the 40, and they've been good about that. So, but they could be Vermonters as well. Mm-hmm. They just may be in a federal.
Yeah, they're in the federal system.
That's correct.
Susie Wiswati, do you have thoughts on that? Is that something, you know, is that an area of focus for thinking about how to sort of return or repatriate the population to Vermont on what we might do with that federal population?
Well, it is news to me that those folks are Vermonters. I didn't realize that.
They could be.
But they're just still general population.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah. So we cannot isolate them just because they are held by the federal marshals. We've actually got case law on isolating out U.S. marshals into segregation, for instance. Because if they don't qualify for the classification, this is getting way down in the weeds, but if they don't qualify for that level of classification, we put them there simply because they're marshals, it runs afoul.
So, Andy, are you saying that my understanding has always been that we rent out some of those beds actually for economic reasons because we actually make more renting out those beds to the feds than we spend on sending people to CCA in Kentucky?
That is a true byproduct of it, but the fact of the matter is, these are beds that the marshals are using for individuals that are under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Marshal District of Vermont.
Okay.
And they have up to about 120 people in their custody, if you will, spread throughout New England. Their preference would be to have them all in Vermont because they're usually facing adjudication in a Vermont court, federal Vermont court.
Okay, good. That's good clarification. We've got a lot of listeners here. Let me get another one to jump right in. Chris is on the line with us from Brattleboro. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question, which is, does the commissioner have an idea of either the number or the percentage of low-risk, nonviolent drug users, drug offenders?
I can answer the low-risk, nonviolent. I couldn't get down necessarily to the particular offense, but I can tell you that about one-third of our male population in Vermont jail, which is 1,900 individuals. About one-third of that population is being detained or sentenced on what you would consider a nonviolent crime. For the women, of which there are about 150, not about, there are 158 women in jail, about two-thirds of that population are being held on a nonviolent crime. I couldn't suggest that they were low risk. That's a whole different exercise.
We're talking today about Vermont's prison population, and we're looking at the fact that almost a quarter of it, generally speaking, almost a quarter of the population serves time outside of Vermont, in Kentucky and then some in Arizona. We're speaking about that issue today and what it might take to be able to have all of our prisoners in state and whether or not that's a good idea. We're hearing from some of you on those thoughts. And as we continue this conversation, we're going to look at what kinds of facilities we might need, what kinds of programs Vermont might need, both for the prison population in general, including an aging population that may need some sort of help in transitional housing as these prisoners come out of prison, as well as what about the state coffers? How are we going to finance it? And we'd like to hear from you. You can post your thoughts at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Mark posted on our Facebook page saying, I understand these are inmates. However, presuming that someday they will be free again and members of society, then making family and friend visits all but impossible feels cruel and unusual, almost in a prisoner of war sort of way. Money or not, I would think Vermont can do better. You can share your thoughts at our Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're taking a look at how Vermont prisoners serve their sentences and why some are housed out of state in Kentucky and Arizona. We're speaking with Andy Polito, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, and with Susie Wizawati, Executive Director of Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform. And we're hearing from many of you who have thoughts and questions on this subject. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, and you can carry on the conversation now and even past the show by going to vpr.net and clicking on Vermont Edition. Let's go right to Jean, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
Hi. I would like to comment on the cost to families of having someone in Kentucky. Mr. Polito commented on the savings to the DOC of having someone in Kentucky. It's almost half the cost of having someone in Vermont. Essentially, that cost is passed along to families. And every time you have to visit someone, there is enormous cost. It requires days off from work. It requires 1,000-mile trip to Kentucky, which takes multiple days. We have a family with young children. We require hotel rooms, meals, gas, a car that can make those kinds of trips multiple times a year. The emotional cost on top of it is huge. As Susie said earlier, maintaining a relationship via phone is expensive, extremely expensive, and that money has to be provided by families.
Jean, this is something that you have some familiarity with, it sounds like. You're talking about your family.
Absolutely.
Traveling down there.
Yes.
And Jean, I appreciate your call and appreciate your thoughts and sharing them with us. Your line was a little fuzzy, so we're going to leave it there. But Susie Wizawati, Jean saying, you know, this is a cost that families have to bear when their family members are out of state. And I assume that's something that you think about in this situation.
Absolutely. You know, it's really sad. And that's why Vermont needs to take care of its own and bring those folks back to in Vermont.
So how would you propose we do that? What's the solution, and where's the sort of bottleneck here? Is it sending fewer people into the system? Is it dealing with them better as they come out? Because we know a lot of people are at the end of their minimum sentence and could get out, but perhaps don't have housing to go to or can't find a suitable place or need some health care and can't find a nursing home that will take a convicted sex offender, for example. So, Susie Wizawati, you start.
Well, so all of those are very real issues, and I think it's clear to everybody who works in this field that there's not any one particular solution. However, by putting together lots of different pieces of the solution, we can come up with a solution. We clearly need more housing. We need to figure out ways to how we can help folks who are the older folks who are either in wheelchairs or walkers or just, you know, I don't think most people know that Vermont has the second largest population of people or percentage of people over 55 in the country. Why do we have so many people over 55 who are still in jail? But I think that it's not so much about releasing people here at this point. It's really about sentencing reform and alternatives to incarceration. And we are making progress there. But the purpose of this campaign is to speed up that progress and to support the state and all the efforts that people are making around the state through nonprofits and through the state to try to come up, strengthen alternatives, strengthen housing options, and what we're not making enough progress on, but we could, is the sentencing reform. We need to decriminalize some of the activities that were years ago weren't crimes. We continue to criminalize more activities every year.
Do you have specifics on what you'd like to see perhaps taken out so that we're not criminalizing?
You know, there is a whole group of low-level crimes that if we looked at that weren't crimes 30 years ago, like simple assault. Two people get into a fight that 20 years ago, if the police were called and they might not have been at all, now the police would have taken the people home and said, you know, sleep it off, guys. And now they get arrested. They're in the court system. Now, depending on the county, they might the charges might be dropped or they might be on probation. But nonetheless, they're in the system. That category of low-level offense doesn't need to be part of our criminal justice system. It's tying up the courts. It ties up resources. It's not the best way for us to be spending the criminal justice resources.
On that note, we have Jason Lorber, a former state representative, calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for hosting this conversation. And I want to thank especially Andy and Susie for their vital work in what's a very difficult situation. I was going to call in and say pretty much exactly what Susie just had said. So you beat me to the punch, Susie, but I agree with you that the bottom line is that we're overusing our prisons and finding alternatives to prison, including less prison time for those in prison is more effective than what we're currently doing.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that perspective. Seconding there what Susie Wisawati was saying. And let's go to Bob Leibel, who's Executive Director of Grassroots Leadership. Bob, you're on the line now. Go right ahead.
Great. Well, thanks so much for hosting this conversation. My comment is about Corrections Corporation of America. This is a company that was founded 30 years ago on the principle that it could sell prisons just like it was selling hamburgers. And some of the problems that the company has encountered around the country include what's happening in Idaho right now, where their facility there got so violent due to understaffing that that it became known as Gladiator School, and the state had to take back control of that facility. And the Kentucky facility that houses Vermont prisoners is also not immune to those kind of problems, where the facility was put under lockdown in January and the warden resigned over an email sent from his iPhone. And I was wondering, does the history of that corporation and do the operations of that corporation play a part in wanting to bring Vermont prisoners back? And does the department take into account some of the problems that the company is having in other parts of the country in hopes that if reducing the prison population and bringing people back to Vermont may prevent those kind of problems from happening with Vermont prisoners? Because I think what the commissioner laid out is really that Vermont facilities here in state really operate very well, really operate very safely, but it certainly can't be said that that's true of CCA facilities around the country.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. And we'll throw that to Commissioner Polito. I mean, you were saying earlier that we don't get many other bids when it right. comes to, but what about this idea that we're sending Vermont prisoners to a for-profit prison corporation who may have an incentive to, certainly has an incentive in terms of a profit motive to have people who are incarcerated? And what's the state's responsibility?
So the only, don't take this as me bailing out CCA, but the state owns this problem 100%. Back in the mid-90s, we made a decision that we were going to lock up more people than we had beds for, rather than make a difficult decision that now we have to do 20 years later, which is to review the criminal code, review sentencing length, all of those things. We decided we were going to dip our toe into the out-of-state market, and at that point, we opened ourselves up to a vulnerability to a market that's much bigger than we are. The economics of it are, frankly, blasé to what happens in Vermont because we have such a small buying power. The only thing I can tell you is monitoring CCA's performance at this date is squarely on the administrative branch, and something that we take very seriously. We send two or three or four people out every couple of weeks to CCA. We spend a fair amount of money on out-of-state travel, even though the secretary and the governor have always wanted to cut down on out-of-state travel. They've never moved against out-of-state travel to CCA facilities, and we have a contract monitor. We're very much involved in CCA's operation. And the one thing I can tell you is we're very involved in personnel changes that have happened over the years, so we are always monitoring that. That doesn't mean that we're not always looking for alternatives. This is
let me redirect you there and think about alternatives, because we're talking about some issues that perhaps we need better transitional housing. And that's an issue whether we have in-state or out-of-state prisoners. Transitional housing is a huge issue for prisoners who may be able to get out, but we have them in the prison system because we don't have a place for them.
But some of this is culture change. So when we go out and get a transitional house, and we have over in the order of magnitude of 300 sites, and they're almost always full. The problem that we have in Vermont are placement of people with sex offense histories. And so we are incredibly unsuccessful in placing people with those kinds of histories in the community. And probably a third of our sentence population right now has a sex offense. And a lot of them are moving beyond their minimum and are lacking residence. And even when the DOC – and this gets back, I think, to Susie's issue, which is this is much bigger than the DOC issue. When those people get ready for reentry, their programming's done, they're ready to go. Residences are hard to come by.
What would you like to see?
I think
communities take these people in, be more willing to take people coming out of prison with a sex offense. Is that the solution?
Or patience, because either we have a little more authority in how we do that, or people have to be more patient that the prison population is going to come down slowly as we work through that. So those are our options. And right now we're at option B because that's the reality of what we're running right now.
Yeah. So Susie Wisawati, what about that? I mean, we're talking here about a culture change. You're talking about a multi-pronged effort here, and it sounds like it could take a while. Are you okay with that?
It's going to take a while, whether I'm okay with it or not. We do need a culture change. We certainly need to look at the whole question of sex offenses. I think it's worth questioning why we have reacted so irrationally and so with so much emotion to sex offenses in this country. We don't have a registry for other kinds of offenses. You know, we don't go and have to disclose this person has a very high possibility of stealing again from Walmart. You know, now I don't want to equate that those are the same kinds of offenses, but you know, we need to remember that when people are in communities and interacting, and everybody knows who they are, and the community deals with them, that the whole community is safer.
Well, and we'll try to put some links up on our webpage to previous shows that we've done about that kind of thing and about circles of justice where community members are involved in helping people who are incarcerated getting out and finding success. Just very, very quickly before we let both of you go, Commissioner Polito, are you going to try to ask the state legislature for more money, more funding for the Department of Corrections this year?
Well, we do have some difficulties with the latest rescission that you're reading about, but the only thing I'll tell you is we're moving towards pretrial services, and we're after a major recidivism grant at the federal level. Those are ways to piece out the front and the back of the system. So we're constantly moving, trying to do it in a way that doesn't put more of a lien on the state.
All right. Well, this conversation is certainly not over. I appreciate both of you being part of it today and helping us discuss a little bit about why we have a prison population out of state and what it might take to make all of our prisoners serve their sentences in state. Andy Polito is the commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Susie Wizawadi is executive director of Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform. She's also a state representative in the Vermont legislature. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why Brandon voters rejected the town budget for the fourth time this month, and we remember Vermont Law School Professor Cheryl Hanna. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Each year, Vermont towns vote on municipal budgets to outline their spending for the coming year. But in Brandon, this process is at an impasse. Last week, voters rejected Brandon's municipal budget plan for the fourth time. Lee Kars is the editor of the Brandon Reporter and joins us now to talk about why the budget has been so difficult to pass. Lee, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Just briefly, what happened in the most recent vote?
Well, it was the fourth vote this year, and it went down by 600 no, 425 yes.
So not very close.
Not very close, and almost all of the budgets this year have been almost 2-1.
Against?
Against, yes.
How does this year's budget compare to last year's budget?
This year, it depends on which budget you're looking at, but we're looking at least... It's been 8.5% increase on taxes at town meeting, and then it went to 7.7. Then the third vote was 8.6, and then this last vote was 6.05%. But this didn't happen overnight. I mean, this is a really complex issue that can't be summed up in a sentence.
Well, just give us a couple of sentences then, because, you know, even more than a 6% tax increase over 1 year, you know, might seem high to people. So what are some of the factors?
Well, some of the factors are that Brandon voters have gotten used to 2, 3, and 4% increases over the last decade. And it's been over the last decade of previous management and expense decisions that have kind of led to a perfect storm of budgetary dysfunction, for lack of a better word. We had a over $200,000 drop in revenue because we had to pay for Irene repairs. We lost the last of a federal COPS grant that paid for one of our police officers. So we're down revenues, and we used to have reserve funds that the select board would use to apply to a tax rate that was going up to keep it kind of artificially lower. And those reserves are now all gone. So it's kind of time to pay the piper, and the voters are basically using the power of the vote to say, find another way.
Well, and this is the second year in a row that the budget has gone to multiple votes. It was passed last year after 4 votes.
Yes.
This will go at least to 5. So what proposals are on the table now to get the budget to a point where people might be able to vote in favor of it?
Well, the reasons for people voting no are as varied as the people themselves in town. It depends on who you ask. Some people are saying they won't vote yes until the town collects more than roughly $1 million in delinquent property and tax sewer fees that are out there. Other people say they won't vote yes until cuts are made in the police department. Still others say the rec department has to be cut. And still more say that they're not going to vote yes until the town renegotiates the union contract with AFSCME for town employees, because right now the town contributes 100% of employees' health insurance costs under that contract. So it's a lot of different things, but I think Brandon voters are using the vote to voice their opinions, and they're feeling powerless in the face of absolute tax increases that have to happen. And from the board's perspective, they think that things like a healthy police force and a rec department and economic development and reserve funds are needed to make Brandon a viable and family-friendly, safe place where people want to buy houses and build the grand list, which would eventually lower taxes. So you can see both sides, but it's kind of a – both sides have also dug their heels in over these four votes, and they're just now starting to listen to each other a little more and try to compromise.
So you are seeing some signs of listening?
Yeah, they had another epic select board meeting last night that ran almost 4 hours, as they recently have done. And over 80 people attended, and the board is talking about compromise. They're looking at cutting a police officer in eighth position. They're talking about...
Which we should say the police chief had some quotes in... the Rutland paper saying that would be a really bad idea. The department is currently operating with 7 people, but to be fully staffed and to be able to provide 24/7 service, he says we need that eighth position.
Right, right. And he's right. But something's got to give, is what the no voters are saying. The board hasn't moved on that decision yet to cut that eighth position. They have moved to cut the public works director position in half, to cut another full-time public works employee, and to reduce the rec director's job to 3/4 time and add economic development duties to his job with no change in pay, in an effort to fill some of the vacant positions like zoning and economic development that we have right now. It's not a great time in Brandon. We have a lot of issues.
Well, and Lee, we just have a couple seconds left, but, you know, we are a month into the new fiscal year. Is Brandon paying the bills?
Yes. They have a current use note with the local bank that they're using to draw funds to pay the bills, and they have a very negligible interest rate of like 1.7%. But that's going to come due in September, and they are going to have to pay that money back. Right now, they've spent about $250,000 to pay the bills until the budget gets passed. So,
well, and the next vote coming up the same day as Vermont's primary election. Lee Kars is the editor of the Brandon Reporter. She's been telling us about how town voters have rejected the municipal budget 4 times now. Lee, thank you so much for being on the program.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yesterday afternoon, news of the death of Cheryl Hanna reverberated around Vermont. Best known as a professor at Vermont Law School, Hanna was frequently seen, heard, and read in Vermont media, demystifying complicated legal concepts and court decisions. We always appreciated her perspective as a guest on this program, and VPR listeners have heard her commentaries for more than 15 years, some on legal issues and some more personal in nature. Equal to her passion for explaining the law to others was a commitment to women's rights and gender equality. In that work, she collaborated frequently with the Vermont Commission on Women, and we asked Executive Director Carrie Brown to reflect on Cheryl Hanna's work and collaboration with the commission.
Cheryl was a great friend and colleague to the Vermont Commission on Women. She was a partner to us. She and her students worked to research and draft the most recent edition of our publication, The Legal Rights of Women in Vermont, which has been distributed throughout the state and is used by women everywhere who are going through divorce, who are considering adoption, who have custody issues, women in prison. And it's just had a tremendous impact on women all over the state. Cheryl also, with her students, drafted the brief that was submitted on our behalf with the first case that used Vermont's equal pay law last year. And she wrote this wonderful brief that talked about the importance of the equal pay law and gave a great rationale for why we still need to be concerned about equal pay for women, that this is not an issue that we're done with yet. And she never turned down an opportunity to help us, to even if it was just quick requests for, can you help us understand this? Can you give us some advice? As many people know, she was a mentor to young women and to girls. She was a Girl Scout leader. She spoke passionately about her involvement with the Girl Scouts. I've never known anyone who was such a great ambassador for the Girl Scouts and the leadership opportunities that that organization can provide. And she took that very seriously and really embodied it personally.
Where do you think her advocacy came from? Did she ever talk to you about her motivations?
Well, she spoke a lot about growing up with her mom, who worked in an auto plant, and seeing her mom struggle.
A single mom,
that's right. And her own sense of what she wanted to do, knowing what she wanted to do and the obstacles that she encountered along the way. And she spoke about her own challenges, learning to negotiate for herself on her own behalf at work and overcoming that. And so she had a terrific way of personalizing some of the struggles that so many women face and making it very relatable. So we could see, oh, here's this very successful woman who has encountered some of the same challenges that all of us have. And I think she served as a real inspiration to so many of us that way.
What are you thinking about today as you reflect on the loss of Cheryl Hanna to the community that she served?
I think of all the times that Cheryl had reached out to someone and gave them some encouragement, that all the young women who she recommended for opportunities and helped to pursue their dreams, and people who will be turning to her and finding her not there and finding that gap, as well as people in the legal community who are looking for some of her scholarship and her research and her advice and counsel that won't be there. And I think that'll be quite a large hole to fill. And hopefully there will be many of the women that she touched along the way who will take her message of empower yourself and stand up for yourself to heart and find opportunities to do that now.
Carrie Brown is the Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women. Thank you for sharing your reflections on the impact of Cheryl Hanna's life.
Thank you. I'm glad to have had the opportunity.
And as we close today, we want to share with you a story that Cheryl recorded for VPR this spring. In May, she participated in the VPR Commentators Brunch, where a room full of guests heard her classic sense of humor and enthusiastic voice loud and clear.
My name is Cheryl Hanna, and I'll be reading a piece called Poetic Justice. After having spent years forcing my younger sister to play student with me as the teacher, it came as no surprise to my family when I decided to go to law school to become a professor. I was so excited when I finally got to meet with the faculty advisor for those of us who wanted to teach. For now, I'll just call him Professor Kingsfield for reasons that will become apparent. So Professor Kingsfield met with me, asked a couple of questions, and after just a few seconds said, "I don't think you're law professor material." Just like that, not law professor material. Now, it was bad enough that Professor Kingsfield said this to me, but what was worse was that I believed him. For a good long while, I tried to shift gears and started making all sorts of regrettable decisions. I passed on key opportunities, made not-so-smart personal choices, and even practiced law for a while. I was a terrible lawyer. I even passed out once in court. Thank goodness something deep inside me inched me back to a teaching career. A few years later, I saw Professor Kingsfield at an alumni reception. He read my name tag and extended his hand. "Professor Cheryl Hanna, so pleased to meet you. I just read your article in the Law Review, and it's very brave. You're the kind of alum that makes us proud." "You don't remember me, do you?" I asked. He shook his head. And so, fueled by youthful, self-righteous indignation and fortified by three glasses of cheap reception wine, I looked at him straight in the eye and said, "Well, I can't repeat what I said." But I made clear in language as colorful as possible that he had almost ruined my life and had no business advising students. He stood there in shock as my friends dragged me away. It was poetic justice, my friends, poetic justice indeed. In my more sober moments, I do try to give him the benefit of the doubt. I was a young woman and not from a prominent family or an Ivy League college. I expect that he'd never known a professor quite like me. He likely had limited ideas of what lawyers should look like, even though I was standing there in plain sight. Which is why I constantly try hard to look beyond what I think is obvious in my own students, to see them as they one day hope to see themselves.
That was a previously unaired recording of Cheryl Hanna speaking at a VPR event in May. Hanna died on Sunday in Burlington. She was 48. And that does it for today's show. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.